The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this 7-day sesshin here at Mountain Gate in the winter, January 2016. And I'd like to share with you today some of the teachings of Sokeon, who was the first Zen master to actually reside in the United States long term. He was eventually the husband of Ruth Fuller, who was Ruth Fuller Sasaki. His original Buddhist name is Shigetsu, and he was known as Sokeon in the United States. Shigetsu Sasaki. I'm going to share his teachings as edited by Mary Farkas, one of his longtime students, in a book called The Zen Eye, a collection of Zen talks by Sokeon. Sokeon taught in the United States in New York City for about 15 years, I think, if I remember correctly. And then eventually he became ill and died. 1945, I think it was. But before that, he had some hassles. It was the Second World War, of course, that ended in 1945. And because he was Japanese, and it was the Japanese that attacked Pearl Harbor, then he was considered quite suspect. It was probably fortunate that he was living on the East Coast at the time, but he was hauled in and questioned, and his life was challenged as a result of his heritage. He had a strong connection with Soyin Shaku, who was the first Buddhist monk to appear in the United States and give a talk at the World Parliament of Religions meeting in Chicago in 1893. He had been invited. He could speak English. Well, no, I'm not sure he could speak English because D.T. Suzuki translated for him. And when he returned to Japan after some time, after his talk, he left D.T. Suzuki in the States to continue translations and to learn English more completely. And D.T. Suzuki served as a housekeeper for Paul Karas, who was a publisher. And he wrote many of his books. D.T. Suzuki was quite prolific in documenting Japanese Zen, particularly Rinzai Zen, in turning it into English. He has quite a few books. And eventually ended up, in his later years, teaching at Columbia University, and that's where Philip Kaplow, more widely known as Kaplow Roshi or Roshi Kaplow, first studied Buddhism. Was under D.C. Suzuki at Columbia University. And as you've already heard, Kaplow Roshi he was a court reporter, and he was actually the head court reporter at, I think it was the Nuremberg trials in Germany, and then he had some status at the war crimes trials in Tokyo at the end of the war. And during his off moments, he would go and visit Buddhist temples, and he was so moved by the great peace that was felt in these beautiful gardens, the deep quiet and deep peace that of course comes as a result of literally centuries of meditation done in those areas. When you walk into a Zen temple, into a Zendo in particular, one that has been established for a while and one which has been actively sat in, meaning meditated in, for some time, there's a sense of deep quiet, almost a mystical sense in them. And for people who are sensitive, it can be picked up on and inspiring. And that's what happened with Kapler-Roshi, and he finally, after the end of the war, after the end of the war crimes trials, he returned to the United States and started taking those courses at Columbia under D.T. Suzuki. And I gather that Kapler-Roshi was relatively full of himself in those days. Even when I knew him, he loved to perform. And I gather that his fellow classmates started getting a little sick and tired of his talking about Zen all the time, and they said, in essence, shut up or put up. And so he did. He sold everything, which he later was immensely grateful for, because he said if he hadn't done that, hadn't burnt all his bridges in the United States, he would have fled Zen practice many, many times. And he did go to Japan and first spent 3 months with Nakagawa Soen Roshi, who spoke some English. And Soen Roshi, seeing his potential, allowed him to sit at the temple, allowed him to live there. He couldn't go into the Zendo. That was for the serious practitioners. And all he had to do was to sit 1 hour a day. Could be any time of day, didn't matter, it was up to him. Could sit in the garden, he could sit in his room, he could sit wherever except in the Zendo. That was the only requirement of him. And so that's how he got his feet wet in Zen. He also was taken along when Nakagawa Soen Roshi went to visit his many friends who were artists and poets and musicians, and that was right up Kapler-Roshi's alley. He loved poetry and art and music. And in fact, in the early years of the Rochester Zen Center, the earliest years of the Rochester Zen Center, he tried out playing music during a sesshin in hopes it would inspire people to go deeper in the meditation. And the one person that I heard from who had been at that sesshin said it was tremendously distracting for him. But always at the Rochester Zen Center, the last moments at the end of sesshin, there is the Kyosaku ceremony and the final talk of the Roshi, and the Roshi exits, and immediately there is some exquisite music played. Usually it is a Beethoven piece, part of a Beethoven symphony called After the Storm, which is always seemed to be incredibly aptly named. And there's something amazing about having sat and purified one's mind for a whole 7 days, and suddenly this music comes, and it is incredible. Just incredible. We don't do it here, we don't really have the setup to do it, but in Rochester, it is quite wonderful, at least for people who like music. I don't know how it is for people who don't like music, but at any rate, so back to Soke-On. He actually was the son of his father, but because his mother couldn't bear children, his father brought in a concubine for 2 years who took the place of his wife. I don't know where his wife went. Maybe she stayed in the house. I don't know. And there's nothing said about that. And until the concubine bore a son, it was Soke-On, and then she left and was paid handsomely, apparently, for that feat. And immediately got married and had a number of other children. But Soke-On's foster mother, stepmother, whatever you want to call her, was apparently deeply caring of Sokyeon and really treated her, it treated him as her own son. And so he grew up, and then at 14, his father died. And the family had been a samurai family, but the samurai were disbanded during the Meiji Restoration. And apparently samurai were issued government bonds or some form of periodic payment. And Sokyeon's father had been cashing them in over the years to survive, and so there was almost nothing left, and not enough to give him anything. And his mom, stepmom, was taken back in by her family, who had enough money to support them. But when Sokyeon had finished middle school, the family decided that he'd had enough schooling, and so they apprenticed him to a woodcarver, and he learned to carve dragons. He apparently had some artistic aptitude. And then after some time in this apprenticeship, he left and wandered all over Japan for a year. And whenever he heard there was a new temple going to be built or one that was going to be renovated, he went there and got work carving. And then when he returned from his year, he started art school in Tokyo. And eventually ended up, partly because he was working in a bank to help support his studies. And other students working in the bank were philosophy students, university students, and they would talk about things. And he became interested in some of these terms that they would bandy about, and that brought him to Zen practice. And he began sitting Zen in a rather unusual temple circumstance. It wasn't actually a temple, it was a group that was started by a Zen master who felt that the priestly Buddhism in Japan had gotten pretty rotten. And wasn't really worth much. And so he started a lay group that did a lot of sitting. Every month there was a sesshin, and there were intensives at other times as well. And so that was Sokyeon's initial practice. And eventually he connected with another teacher, and also with that teacher's teacher, who happened to be Soyin Shaku, who's famous because of his having spoken at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. Eventually, of course, as you just heard, Sokyeon ended up in the United States and with a group of Zen teachers who finally gave up and went back to Japan after a bit, leaving him there to learn about America and American culture. Soyin Shaku told him that was the most important thing for him to do, to learn about and understand American culture. So he wandered all over, at least the West, and sometimes he would disguise himself as a Native American. And Americans not being that familiar with Japanese, at least not in the Midwest, who didn't know the difference. And eventually he ended up starting a sitting group in New York City. And it is from that sitting group that these talks came. Apparently his English was rather slow because, as he put it, he had to think in English, come up with the words in English that he wanted to express, and then he had to go into a deep, it's called Dharmakaya, the teaching body. It's a place, a mind place, where Sokeon had disappeared and the teaching came forth clear and undisguised and unhindered by any self-conscious awareness, any ego. And so his talks were slow enough that it was easy for his students to try to copy them out. And eventually Mary Farkas, his probably most senior student, took them all and edited them, and this book, The Zen Eye, is the result. So I'd like to share at least a couple of things, I think, with you today. First thing is called Buddha nature. Everyone thinks that Buddha is different from everyday human beings. Everyone thinks that Buddha is different from everyday human beings. And that is something that is perhaps the first hurdle that students of Zen need to get beyond. As Hakuin said, there's nothing outside us. There's nothing we lack. Nirvana is openly shown to our eyes. This earth where we stand is the pure lotus land, this very body, the body of Buddha. But we keep thinking it's something else. Or some distinct aspect of ourselves. Not that we are Buddha nature, but we're me and we're Buddha nature, which isn't accurate. Everyone thinks that Buddha is different from everyday human beings. Some Buddhists believe that Buddha has been living for 1 million years in the western sky. We have no relation to such a Buddha. We have nothing to do with a Buddha living in the western sky. Our own Buddha nature is Buddha. Of course, sentient beings are like orphans who never knew their own home. Once there was a child who had been abandoned. He grew up and heard that his true home was in another village. He went to the village to find his home. Through all the streets of the village he went, visiting every house. He went into and came out of his own home, but never realized it. Every person has Buddha nature within him. Going into it and coming out of it, we never realize that it is our own Buddha nature. The child finally found his home and suddenly realized that all the neighbors living there were his relatives, his cousins, uncles, and aunts. Once in a long while, a human being realizes Buddha nature within themselves. Then suddenly they realize that their hand is the hand of Buddha, the lotus hand. They realize that they themselves are Buddha. There is no other Buddha in the world. There is no other Buddha in the world. We are Buddha. We don't recognize it, just like the child going in and out of his own house and not recognizing it as his, because we have so much conditioning, so many ideas, so many assumptions, so many experiences that we draw conclusions about ourselves through. What is the true self? This is our fundamental task in practice, searching for our true self. And we have this wonderful practice, Sosokan, the extended out-breath, is highly effective in uncovering this true self. If we give ourselves really with great commitment to this extending of the out-breath and the searching, the reaching beyond words that is made more readily available to us through the extension of the out-breath, eventually we will find out who we really are. The extension of the out-breath. If there's anything hidden in our psyche, that extension of the out-breath, which requires letting go of everything else in order to make it happen, you can't extend your out-breath and think about a lot of other things at the same time. You have to be totally focused on the physical experience of breathing out. And then you can take it often a long, long way. But if there is anything sticky in your history, anything sticky in your mind, any conditioning that is intense, then it may be difficult to extend that out-breath. And if you find you can't breathe out very far, then the way to work with it is to tune in to the physical experience of not being able to breathe out very far, not being able to catch your breath, perhaps. Feel it in your body. Don't think about it. Thinking won't get you anywhere. Feel it in your body. And if you find yourself with a tightness in your throat, tune into that. Tune into that. Little by little, we see where we are caught. We see the hard shell, the crust of ego, of assumptions about life, of conditioning. Sooner or later it comes up during Zazen. Initially, when it does, we are generally pretty dismayed because we think that our Zen practice isn't working at all. Particularly if we have a hard time focusing our mind, particularly if we can't seem to get the breath very far out. But actually, that is practice. And practice is what is required with it to keep trying, to keep trying. When you're first sitting down at a piano, about to take some piano lessons, you can't play Rachmaninoff. You can't play Tchaikovsky. You can't probably even play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. But as you work on it, as you practice, gradually you become more able to play more difficult pieces. And if you persist, eventually you can play Rachmaninoff. You can play Tchaikovsky. It is the same with Zen practice. Initially it seems very difficult. There may be times when it seems easier. But if you persist, you're going to see some things that you might not want to see. Suzuki Roshi, not D.T. Suzuki, but Shunryu Suzuki, in his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, talks about this and speaks of the situation as having mind weeds. And just as I was recently in Amish County, Pennsylvania, saw a lot of what's known as green fertilizer there growing in the winter. Fields full of the kind of thing that if you plow it under in the spring, it provides really excellent fertilizer for the next crop. And that's what's normally done with it. It's not harvested, it's plowed under to replenish the soil. And the same with these difficult emotions, sudden comprehension that our behavior hasn't been quite as ideal as we would like to think it has been, to tune in, to feel the whole experience fully, then they become green fertilizer. And your practice can go deeper as a result. What you don't want to do with those things is try to shove them back in the box, because they'll drive you subconsciously if you do that. And Zen practice is about becoming free of our conditioning, free of our stuff, free of greed, anger, and delusion. In particular, the delusion that we are somebody that needs to be defended, that has a particular image. So if we're not that, who are we? Who are we? It's a very important question. Don't bother seeking it out intellectually. You'll just come up with lots of ideas. You have to go beyond. To go beyond. To enter samadhi, where that self-image is forgotten. Now, before you get an idea of what samadhi is, just know that there are various different levels of it. And don't get attached to it. There's no point. Just know that you want to absorb yourself in extending that out-breath and the wordless questioning, whether it's the questioning of a koan or whether it's simply opening to what might lie beyond your ordinary consciousness that you can realize if you reach farther enough in the breath or through the breath. If you do that, naturally, eventually, you will enter samadhi. You won't have to try to do it. He speaks also about the body of Buddha. Your body is not bounded by the surface of your skin. You know, the sun and the moon are your body. The oceans and rivers are your body. The whole universe is your body. The Buddha built his religion upon this mind, this consciousness. Sometimes you call it body, sometimes you call it God. We don't use any name for it. When you observe that your mind is as boundless as the sky, then you can't invent this. Sometimes people relatively early in their practice come up with what they think is that mind state. But it's not. It's still a delusive condition. When you observe that your mind is as boundless as the sky, an endless universe, and your present state, this moment, is here. That is all. When you have to express yourself by speech, you must realize it is not Zen. All the writings are in your heart. They are inherent, the intrinsic law of your nature. You cannot find us anywhere outside yourself. Because people can come up with what they think is a state of samadhi. We had one person here for a while who kept talking about his samadhi, and it wasn't. It wasn't. It was some vacant mind state that he'd conjured up. It's important to work with a teacher who has experience, long experience, under a teacher of long experience who is also sanctioned by a teacher of long experience. And this is one of the benefits of Rinzai Zen. Generally speaking, authentic realization is required. A teacher doesn't ordinarily accept something less because it would be unfair to the student. Of course, here and there are teachers who haven't really gone deeply enough. Some even who have had a Kensho, some even who have been authorized by their own teachers to teach. And then there are some who just decide upon themselves to teach anyway, without that authorization. The main point is for each of us to give ourselves completely to our practice. completely to the experience of that out-breath, a stretching beyond. And eventually, if we do that long enough, deeply enough, with enough commitment, focus, and intensity. Now, this is a grounded intensity too. We'll realize what we want to realize. So this little cough seems to be getting the best of me, and probably better to stop here rather than put you guys to suffer any longer with it. So we'll stop now and recite the four vows. And thank you for listening.